I'm referring to my military service in over 3.5 years. And I was only in the combat zone for 6 months, a little over 6 months. But in my work role in the military, I was a radio operator, and a very good one. Commended and citations. But when it came to Army life, I was a very bad soldier. I was disobedient and undisciplined. I was a bad boy. I was never sent to the stockade or anything like that, but I just did dislike military life a whole lot. But
how did you become radio operator?
I don't know. I enlisted in the Air Corps, and I knew I wanted to be in the Air Corps because that was kind of a sanitary form of military life. And I went to, I guess I was a good student, because they gave you these aptitude tests, and then they sent us off to school after basic training, Miami Beach. Oh, God, it was awful. 5 o'clock in the morning, with some idiot making you do push-ups in the sand.
That's hard.
Before breakfast. Breakfast was all that grease and garbage. But they sent me off to a radio school to become a radio operator. And they sent me to an advanced radio operator school. And they sent us on maneuvers. And they sent us to a secret school to study. It turned out to be a form of ground control of fighter aircraft squadrons. And you remember seeing movies of the operations board with the they have sticks and they push the little pictures of fighter squadrons around. Well, back out in the boonies, on the ground, there are little radio operators doing direction finding machines that told them where the fighters were located and where the enemies were pinpointed, and that was fighter control, and I was very good at that.
So was it a form of espionage at all? Or?
No. We
just strategy.
It was a way of directing the fighter squadrons to the target, and then bringing them back. For a while in the service, I was a Homer operator. I would listen to a broadcast beep. One of the planes in each squadron would send out a secret signal on ultra-high frequency. And that beep tone would focus in on it, get the pinpoint the location of the squadron, and then radio vectors. It's a World War II. We would vector them and give them directions how to fly, and then bring them back to the base. And my code name was Browning. And
so you played an important part in your job.
Oh, yeah, it was...
So you felt productive and...
Yes, excuse me. Found them at a...
I was asking, you felt very productive then in the war, or...
Oh, yeah. All I did was vegetate.
No. Obviously you had a very important position.
I went into combat during the Battle of the Bulge. And we were, to use a military term, we were getting our ass kicked. And it was real bad. Things were going very badly. And we turned things around with these fighter planes and directed them to attack the home bases. And eventually did obliterate pretty much the German Air Force.
And where did some of the bombings occur? It would be interesting.
The bombing.
Yes. Do you remember some of the cities that you bombed, or some of the areas that your work brought?
Well, there were targets all over Germany, but Northwest Germany were the targets for my particular squadron. I was located on the ground at that time in Germany near a town called Aachen, A A C H E N,
which is right on the Belgian border.
I was in Malmedy when Malmedy, Belgium, when our planes bombed it. We were bombed by our own bombers. The town was clobbered. I was outside town, thank God, but there were a lot of American boys killed by... We now understand this accidental sort of thing that happens. It's known now as friendly fire.
Yeah.
In those days, it was known as a screw-up.
Do you remember how many of our boys died in that? Or?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Nearby, there was another atrocity. The Germans killed in a field not far from us. Wiped out a whole company of American prisoners. They killed, murdered them. They were captured, they surrendered to the Germans, and the Germans at that time were apparently unable to deal with prisoners. They were on the move and they didn't want to take prisoners back.
And
so they killed them, they murdered them.
What year was that, do you remember?
That was the last year of the war.
Yeah.
And
so do you remember the bombings, like major cities like Hamburg and Frankfurt and Dresden, or was it just a more general thing that you...
I rarely knew
okay.
what specific targets they were hitting at the time we were directing the flights.
Okay.
We were giving directions to the fighter planes that accompanied the bomber squadrons.
Okay.
And our squadron attacked a lot of ground targets. But what they were, I don't know.
Okay.
Back at headquarters, we were giving our radio direction finding signals to a headquarters. Back at that time, it was near Brussels, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hazy about that. And they knew where the targets were, and they knew how to bring they knew what bases the bombers were going back to. My work was concerned with the fighter cover and
okay.
the fighter squadrons.
Okay, so then the war was over and you came home from the war. What did you do then?
Well, I went back to school. My parents persuaded me to change my plans. I think one of the reasons I enlisted in the military was to get away from college, because I was struggling with chemical engineering program, and I almost certainly would have flunked. It was very difficult for me and not very pleasant. When I came back from the war, however, I very seriously wanted to be a bum. I wanted to, what would be the modern day equivalent of it?
Hippie?
A hippie, yeah. Existentialist. I wanted to practice drinking for a while and loafing for a while, and I was totally determined to be a nothing. I'm glad to be alive, to tell you the truth, as I recall. But my parents persuaded me to go back to school, and as a compromise with them, I decided to study journalism.
And that was at the University of Pittsburgh again?
Yeah, yeah. And that's how I happened to get into journalism.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. You see,
how long did you practice?
Before I went to the war, I had been on the staff of the Pitt News as a kind of a lark.
Okay.
And the Pitt Panther magazine as a kind of a lark. I was also in the band, and I was also in some other student activities, the freshman dance. And I was more socially adjusted at Pitt than scholastically. When I came back from the war, I had already had some experience writing for the campus newspaper, so I decided to pursue that, and it was really interesting study. And I met Bob Graham, who was the head of the journalism program at the University of Pittsburgh, who was a really neat guy and a good teacher, and I found that I had some ability to write. And with his help, and with an English teacher named Irvine, I became interested in my studies, and I decided not to be a bum, not to be a dilettante.
How long were you a bum after the war?
My parents allowed me an adjustment period. I was in the VA hospital, and with a bad knee that I got, I came back in the hospital. They allowed me a couple of months, and then decided that I ought to get up off my ass and do something, like all Jewish boys should. And it was a few months, I suppose.
You were shot in the knee, or just?
I was. It was a bombing. I guess maybe it was the might be the last bomber plane in the German Air Force. It was a single plane, and he dropped a bomb on our radio location on top of a mountain. And at that time, it was in Belgium. We pulled back. We were up in Germany. We pulled back to Belgium, and I watched this flight go over. The war was almost in a total hiatus then. And he dropped the bomb. And I was standing on the roof of a radio station. They were like in the cab in the back of a truck.
Talking about the bombing. You were on top of the roof?
Yeah, I watched the bomb fall. Stupid. And it blew me off the top of the truck and ripped up my right leg. But got me out of the war. I think my squadron.
Your squadron went off to the Pacific?
Yeah, I never did find out. I was transferred to another outfit.
What year was that? Then? Your squadron, what year was this bombing?
That was just immediately days before the war ended,
okay.
Formally ended.
Okay, so that was in 45 then?
I went to the hospital, and what happened to them I don't know. When I got out of the hospital, I was in another outfit.
Okay.
I was with the 48th Fighter Group, which had been, they were 48th had been, I forget where the hell they had been. They'd gone through a tough experience too. And I went with them back to the staging area, and instead of going to the Pacific, they came back to the United States. I was on crutches after the war, and when my knee healed, I went out for the swimming team for therapy, for treatment. And that was one of the fun things about going back to school, too. We had a swimming team was made up of about 5 or 6 guys. And I think normally a swimming team has maybe 30 people on it. Maybe 40. I don't know what they do now, but in those days we had a team of about 6 of us. We're all veterans. And all pretty much trying to recover from war experiences. And one of the guys was Billy Manco, who had been a prisoner for more than a year. And he had dark shadows in his life that he was trying to exorcise. A couple of the other guys had been in combat and veterans, and we went back on the GI Bill. It's a terrific thing. And we were a good swimming team. With 5 or 6 of us, we went into the Eastern Collegiates and won 5th place in the Eastern United States. And that was a good experience.
What interests me a little bit, because based on what you just said a minute ago, there have been so many criticisms of how veterans have been treated through the last wars, since the Second World War, and some of the Vietnamese soldiers and all the veterans that have come back. There's been tremendous criticism, now even as recent as the Gulf War. How did you feel that the Army treated their veterans after the war? And what do you think the attitude was of you veterans coming home? What was the climate as you came home?
We came home on a banana boat, literally. It was United Fruit Company. And I remember being seasick when I went overseas, seasick every day on the trip over, 11 days. Coming back, it was 9 or 10 days, and I was seasick every day. And I slept on the deck in the fresh air to avoid going into the cramped hold.
What kind of welcome did you get?
We came into New York Harbor, and it was one of the most magnificent, thrilling experiences of my life. There are a lot of ships in New York Harbor, but there were in those days, because there was a lot of traffic and communication between the United States and the theaters of war. There were a lot of ships in the harbor, and when our troop ship came into the harbor, they blew their whistles, and they waved their flags. They had their flags out. And there were fireboats from the city of New York squirting water high in the air, And our boat steamed through the harbor, the outer harbor, the inner harbor, and up under the George Washington Bridge. And all of the plants and the industrial firms and facilities along the shore tooted their whistles and screamed. It was magnificent. It was a welcome home. It was, and of course, maybe I overdramatized, but I think I recall that I was glad to be alive. That I didn't really expect to be alive. That I had hated the experience that I'd been through, and when I came back to that welcome, it was magnificent. I remember we transferred from the ship to a ferry boat. I couldn't handle my crutches on the steps, and I fell head first down the steps. And I would not let that stop me. They carried me, literally carried me, onto the ferry boat. And we went further up the Hudson River on the ferry boat. And I remember a Milky Way. Literally, we had been deprived of certain foods. I was just a kid, a punk kid, and I missed milk very much, and many of the young kids on the boat did. So they had free milk. They had as much as we wanted, and they had ice cream in little cups, and I hadn't had ice cream for God knows how long, and we pigged out.
Are those the two things?
On those two things. Later, when we got back to the Camp Shanks, I think it was, outside New York City, we did the beer thing. But that night on the ferry boat, we were doing ice cream and milk, and the containers being thrown overboard into the river left a wake behind literally a Milky Way down the middle of the river. I don't know who cleaned it up, but there were thousands of containers of milk and ice cream containers. It was just joyous.
It was a Milky Way on the water, not up in the sky.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, that was the start of the welcome home. That it was tumultuous when I came back to Pittsburgh, of course. It was heaven. I remember the people being very, very in the community. If you were in a uniform, you were a saint of God. There was a USO in downtown Pittsburgh somewhere, in one of the old hotels. I think it was the Fort Pitt Hotel. That they had free tickets to shows and dances, and they just couldn't do enough for the veterans.
And how were you accepted at school? You were now integrated with students who had not been in the war. How did that work out? You were older?
Yeah. Older, and I don't recall any problems.
Okay.
And I wasn't that much older than my... I'd been away 3 years, so I was maybe 4 years older than my other classmates. But I did get into that journalism study that I enjoyed a whole lot. I was a proficient writer, and Miss Irvine, I mentioned her name, gave me a job as a student reader, and I helped her grade student papers. She's the first school teacher I ever met who drank beer. We had beer together.
She was a professor, is that it? Or?
Yeah, a very, very talented teacher. Because I was on the swimming team, and the athletic teams were given certain advantages. I was in a class of jocks, and I know she chewed me out. I didn't really understand, but apparently there was some kind of unwritten rule that everybody in the class should get an A. And I know she chewed me out and said that I should not be in that class at all because I was a capable writer. And maybe she was stroking me or feeding my vanity or whatever, but I did work very hard for her. And Bob Graham, the journalism instructor, got me a job, or suggested that I apply for a job on a little newspaper in Manesson.
Okay. Manesson Morning News?
I went and I applied for a job in Manesson. They were starting a new newspaper, brand new. It was organized by a group of people active in Manesson and Westmoreland County politics who were upset by the right-wing political posture of the existing newspaper in Manesson and wanted to open up something in competition. These this group, this little syndicate of men, were starting a tabloid. And I got a job as a reporter. Well, I was the staff, as it turned out. There was an editor, and there was me. And we had this little tabloid newspaper, and I sure learned in a hell of a hurry how to do newspaper work. It included setting headlines and helping to compose a newspaper and set type, run a line of type, and do everything. It was marvelous. And I loved it. And it lasted about 6 months before the paper died. That was the Manassas Morning News. I lived in Mount Lebanon then with my parents and drove to work in Manassas every day. It took about an hour each way.
Who owned the Manassas tabloid, do you remember?
There was a group of at least five investors who owned it. The mayor of Manassas was one of them. Hugo Parenti was his name. Judge David Weiss, who was on the Common Pleas Court bench in Westmoreland County, was another. Carl Apone, who was the music critic for the local newspaper, his brother was a businessman in Manassas, was one of the investors. I can't remember all five, but it was a neat little newspaper.
What did you do then?
Well, I was a student at the same time. It was tough. Then we went into the summer hiatus. I think I worked full-time at the newspaper until it collapsed, until it died.
Do you remember what you earned?
No, I don't. It would be an interesting figure because I think it was very little.
Sure.
But how did the chronology go? The newspaper failed. I went back to school.
You were still in school, actually, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the day after graduation, I went to work in McKeesport. For radio station WMCK, which was owned by a merchant in McKeesport named Robert Cox, Cox's department store. And he had the license and the radio station. I was the news editor, which meant that I had to write the news for the DJs to read. And I worked there morning, noon, and night, and that was a good experience too. And I was there for three and a half years, covering the local news scene in McKeesport, in the Mon Valley, and writing news for the radio station. I ran my tail off, and we did a pretty good job. And I loved that work a whole lot. I just really enjoyed being a newsman. I accidentally got into the career, but I guess I was tailor-made for it. Or it suited me to a T, and it was kind of interesting.
Did you do any broadcasting at that moment?
No, I never did. I would write news and write newscasts, and sometimes I would be out of the station covering other news for having prepared the newscast for the DJs, the disc jockeys who were on the air then, would read their own newscasts. They would stop doing the music and do a separate little newscast with the introduction and the... I didn't do the commercials, but they would handle all of that. All I did was the news content. And we became so influential in the community, I eventually got an assistant so that he could work in the evenings. And I would start the early morning shift, and we would overlap in the afternoons, running all over town and covering news. Excuse me. While I was at radio station WMCK in McKeesport, I used to telephone stories to the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph. Should I go on and tell you about my career in journalism?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
That's what I'm getting into.
I could get $5 or $10 by telephoning a newspaper, a story, to the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph. The Pittsburgh Press had their own staffer. Asa Atwater was his name. And we became friends, And he was a marvelous newspaper man, and he helped me, he taught me a lot. His sister was the secretary to the mayor in McKeesport. So even though he was my, we competed toe-to-toe, head-to-head, I still love him. He was a marvelous person. And we competed, desperately competed to get news. And he, for the Pittsburgh Press, and I for the Sun-Telegraph, for WMCK, for phoning news stories to the Sun-Telegraph, which was his competition. Well, I got a lot of news stories. And eventually, I became so well-known at the Sun-Telegraph that they decided to save money by putting me on their payroll, because I was getting a pretty good chunk of change phoning news tips to them. One of the stories I phoned to them that they gobbled up, they just loved this one. I was driving home one wintry night. It's a raw evening. You know how it is around here sometimes. It's dismal and damp and very British, London and foggy. And there was a bridge from the end of McKeesport across the river to Dervosburg, and the pavement was wooden blocks. They don't do that anymore. But there were blocks of wood and slippery as hell. And I was driving up a ramp to go across the river, the Monongahela River, on that bridge, when some maniac went past me at 100 miles an hour while I was turning the bend, and he went scooting around me, and his lights went across the bridge ahead of me, and all of a sudden they disappeared. Yes, you gasp, he did. He skidded on the blocks of wood and went through the railing into the river. I couldn't believe it. I got across the bridge. There's a gaping hole in the railing, and I got out of my car, and I looked down into the river. He missed the water and landed on the riverbank in the mud.
Oh my God.
His car had flipped through the air, and he landed wheels down. And his headlights were shining down on the riverbank. And he was unhurt. Needless to say, he was drunk as a skunk. But eventually the firemen had to come and lay ladders on the mud in order to crawl out and to get him out of this goo, out of his car. And they got the car out, they got him out. He was unhurt. He plunged through the railing and dropped 10 stories the river below and was unhurt. I phoned that story to the Sun-Telegraph. Do you remember Reed Cordick? And subsequently, we had the bridge leap contest. We had the bridge to nowhere. And the Fort Duquesne Bridge ended without connecting ramps, ended high in the air. And somebody did the same sort of thing here in Pittsburgh and drove, a drunk drove through the railing, the guard barriers, and flipped in the air. But he was injured. But Reed Cordick memorialized that event by having the bridge leap contest. The man who won the contest, it was some sort of, you had to write a little essay in 25 words or less, and the guy who won the contest, of course, was able to say, I did it and lived. But that was one of the stories I phoned to the Sun-Telegraph. They offered me a job at the Sun-Telegraph and I as a staffer, and I jumped at it, and I left McKeesport and went to Pittsburgh, to the Sun-Telegraph, and I worked at the Sun-Telegraph for about 6 years.
As
a reporter, most of the time was spent as the beat reporter on the courthouse beat, the county government. I started, of course, I did the customary break-in period as an apprentice. I did obits, and one of my training jobs was doing the church page. God, that was awful.
Why?
Because it was boring. It was tedious. Titles of little sermons and little gossip items about what's happening in the various churches. I think it was the Saturday newspaper carried a page of church news. There was no financial news on Saturday, so they had the church news about what was coming up at all the district churches the following day, and special guest speakers were coming to this church or that, and the church editor was a gray-haired, old, kindly old man. And I was his assistant for a while, training.
Any synagogues involved in that, too? Or just
oh, yes, of course.
Okay,
right.
Okay.
Right. It's covered every I don't especially remember any of the stories that I did write, little stories. They would be one or two paragraph things, and they would be set up in type, and there were maybe 100 of those damn things on one page. It was awful. I mean, and writing obits, and writing obituaries for the morgue, our library. The newspaper was very, very glamorous. We had a city room that was filled with some of the greatest newspapermen of ever, marvelous characters.
Names?
Joseph Patrick Brown was one of the guys I worked with. He was a hell-bent for leather reporter at City Hall. You know Joe Patrick. Joe Brown was eventually, in these past few years, has been wrote a personalized column. But he was in those days a hard-drinking, hard-working dynamo in City Hall. Another man in our team of beat reporters was Dave Welty, who just recently retired as the mayor's press secretary. Dave Welty was in those days the police beat reporter.